Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Professor Nancy Fraser of the New School for Social Research delivered the 2009 Storrs Lecture at Yale Law School. Her first lecture is entitled Marketization, Social Protection, Emancipation, Toward a Neo-Polinian Conception of the Capitalist Crisis. This lecture was delivered on Monday, October 5th, 2009.
Thank you so much, Dean Post, for that very gracious introduction. And I want to thank you and former Dean Coe for this invitation and everybody who has made it possible. I have to say, listening to your account of the list of previous Storrs lectures is quite humbling, even intimidating. But I will somehow try to do justice to this very eminent series. As Dean Post mentioned, my title is Marketization, Social Protection, Emancipation, Toward a Neo-Polanyian Conception of Capitalist Crisis. And I want to start by making an observation about the landscape of critical theory today. It seems to me that the current crisis of neoliberalism is altering that landscape. During the last two decades, I would say that most theorists kept their distance from the sort of large-scale social theorizing associated with Marxism. Apparently accepting the necessity of academic specialization, they settled on one or another branch of disciplinary inquiry conceived as a freestanding enterprise. Whether the focus was jurisprudence or moral philosophy, democratic theory or cultural criticism, the work proceeded in relative disconnection from fundamental questions of social theory. The critique of capitalist society, pivotal for earlier generations, all but vanished from the agenda of critical theory. Critique centered on capitalist crisis especially was pronounced reductive, deterministic, and de passé. Today, I would suggest such verities lie in tatters. With the global financial system teetering, worldwide production and employment in freefall, and the looming prospect of a prolonged recession, if no longer a global depression, capitalist crisis supplies the inescapable backdrop for every serious attempt at critical theorizing. Henceforth, critical theorists cannot avoid the question of capitalist society. Large-scale theorizing aimed at clarifying the nature and roots of crisis, as well as the prospects for an emancipatory resolution, promises to regain its place in critical theorizing. Yet how exactly should critical theorists approach these matters? How overcome the deficits of discredited economistic approaches, which focus exclusively on the so-called system logic of the capitalist economy? How develop an expanded non-economistic understanding of capitalist society, which incorporates the insights of feminism, multiculturalism, post-colonialism, and the cultural turn more broadly? How conceptualize crisis as a social process in which economics is mediated by history, culture, and geography, politics, ecology, and law? How comprehend the full range of social struggles in the current conjuncture, and how assess the potential for emancipatory social transformation? The thought of Karl Polanyi affords a promising starting point for such theorizing. His 1944 classic, The Great Transformation, elaborates an account of capitalist crisis as a multifaceted historical process that began with the Industrial Revolution in Britain and proceeded over the course of more than a century to envelop the entire world, entraining imperial subjection, periodic depressions, and cataclysmic wars. For Polanyi, moreover, capitalist crisis was less about economic breakdown in the narrow sense than about disintegrated communities, ruptured solidarities, and despoiled nature. Its roots lay less in intra-economic contradictions, such as the supposed tendency of the rate of profit to fall, than in a momentous shift in the place of economy vis-a-vis society. Overturning the heretofore universal relation in which markets were embedded in social institutions and subject to moral and ethical norms, proponents of the so-called self-regulating market sought to build a world in which society, morals, and ethics were subordinated to, indeed modeled on, markets. That aspiration, inherently self-undermining and unrealizable, drove developments so deeply destructive of human society as to spark an ongoing counter-movement for the latter's protection. It was this double movement, unregulated marketization followed by demands for social protection, that led, in Polanyi's view, to fascism and world war. Now, here is an account of capitalist crisis that transcends the cramped confines of economistic thinking. Masterful, capacious, and encompassing action at multiple scales, the Great Transformation weaves together local protest, national politics, international affairs, and global financial regimes in a powerful historical synthesis. Like Marx, Polanyi emphasized social struggle, but in place of the conflict between labor and capital, he foregrounded that between forces favoring marketization and cross-class movements for social protection. Like Marx, too, Polanyi sought to influence history, but his attitude to markets was more complex. Written with the aim of shaping the post-war order, the Great Transformation constitutes a brief for a new democratic regulatory regime that would defang markets, removing their sting without suppressing them altogether. Well, these points alone would qualify Polanyi as a promising resource for those who seek to understand the travails of 21st century capitalist society. But there are other, more specific reasons for turning to him today. The story told in The Great Transformation has strong echoes in current developments. There is at least a prima facie case for the view that the present crisis has its roots in recent efforts to disencumber markets from the regulatory regimes, both national and international, established in the aftermath of World War II. What we today call neoliberalism is nothing but the second coming of the very same 19th century faith in the self-regulating market that unleashed the capitalist crisis Polanyi chronicled. Now, as then, attempts to implement that creed are rending social bonds, destroying livelihoods, and despoiling nature. Now, as then, counterforces are mobilizing to try to halt these depredations. On its face, then, today's crisis is plausibly viewed as a great transformation redux. For many reasons, then, Polanyi's perspective holds considerable promise for theorizing today. Yet critical theorists should not rush to embrace it uncritically. Even as it overcomes economism, the Great Transformation turns out, on closer inspection, to be deeply flawed. Focused single-mindedly on harms emanating from disembedded markets, the book overlooks harms originating elsewhere in the surrounding society. Occulting non-market-based forms of injustice, it also tends to whitewash forms of social protection that are at the same time vehicles of domination. Focused overwhelmingly on struggles against market-based depredation, the book neglects struggles against injustices rooted in society and encoded in social protections. So I'm suggesting that we should not embrace Polanyi's framework in the form in which it appears in The Great Transformation. What is needed, rather, is a revision of that framework. The goal should be a new quasi-Polanyian conception of capitalist crisis that not only avoids reductive economism, but also avoids romanticizing society. That is my aim in the present series of lectures, seeking to develop a critique that comprehends society as well as economy. I propose to broaden Polanyi's problematic to encompass a third axis of social struggle that cross-cuts his central conflict between marketization and social protection. This third axis, which I shall call emancipation, aims to overcome forms of subjection rooted in society. Central to both iterations of the Great Transformation, the one analyzed by Polanyi and the one we are living through now, struggles for emancipation constitute the missing third that mediates every conflict between marketization and social protection. The effect of introducing this missing third will be to transform Polanyi's double movement into a triple movement, encompassing marketization, social protection, and emancipation. The triple movement, I suggest, can form the core of a new quasi-Polanyian perspective that can clarify capitalist crisis in the 21st century. After elaborating this perspective in the present lecture, I will use it to analyze contemporary developments in the lecture that follows tomorrow. So I want to begin by recalling Polanyi's distinction between embedded and disembedded markets, which Dean Post already referred to. Although seldom referenced explicitly in The Great Transformation, this distinction is integral to all of that book's central concepts, including society, protection, crisis, and the double movement. Especially important for my purposes here, it carries strong evaluative connotations, which need to be subject to critical scrutiny. Famously, Polanyi distinguished two different relations in which markets can stand to society. On the one hand, markets can be embedded and meshed in non-economic institutions and subject to non-economic norms, such as the classic just price and the fair wage. On the other hand, markets can be disembedded, freed from extra-economic controls, and governed imminently by supply and demand. The first possibility, claims Polanyi, represents the historical norm. Throughout most of history, in otherwise disparate civilizations and in widely separated locales, markets have been subject to non-economic controls, which limit what can be bought and sold, by whom, and on what terms. The second possibility is historically anomalous. A 19th century British invention, the self-regulating market, was an utterly novel idea whose deployment, Polanyi contends, threatens the very fabric of human society. Now, for Polanyi, markets can never, in fact, be fully disembedded from the larger society. The attempt to make them so must inexorably fail. For one thing, markets can function properly only against a non-economic background of cultural understandings and solidary relations. Attempts to disembed them destroy that background. For another, the attempt to establish self-regulating markets proves so destructive of the fabric of society as to provoke widespread demands for their social regulation. Far from enhancing social cooperation, then, the project of disembedding markets inevitably triggers social crisis. Now, the Great Transformation recounts the process by which British commercial interests sought to engineer that impossible creature, the self-regulating market. In the process, they had to disable the non-economic trappings in which markets had been embedded. Especially crucial was removal of restrictions on the buying and selling of land, labor, and money, previously limited by customary rights and community mores, moral and religious norms, structures of family and kin, local authorities, and of course the mercantilist policies of national states. When the new commercially dominated government of the 1930s and 40s dismantled the system of outdoor relief and the tariffs and subsidies on corn, it effectively denuded land, labor, and money of their protective covering and transformed them into fictitious commodities. Abandoned to the laws of the dismal science, these fundamental bases of human society could now be bought and sold without regard for the consequences, human, social, natural. According to Polanyi, however, society did not endure the assault with equanimity. From the beginning, rural landowners, urban workers, and other strata mobilized to protect endangered livelihoods, communities, and habitats. Defending society against economy, they turned to politics in order to re-embed markets. It was the sharpening struggle between these two camps, the marketizers and the protectionists, that lent the distinctive shape of a double movement to a century and a half of capitalist crisis. If the first prong of that movement, the disembedding prong, took us from a mercantilist phase in which markets were socially and politically embedded to a laissez-faire phase in which they became at least relatively disembedded, the second prong, the counter movement, should carry us, so Polanyi hoped, to a new phase in which markets would be re-embedded in democratic welfare states. The effect would be to return the economy to its proper place in society. In general, then, this distinction between embedded and disembedded markets is central to all of Polanyi's concepts, including society, protection, crisis, and the double movement. Equally important, the distinction is strongly evaluative. Embedded markets are associated with social protection, figured as shelter from the harsh elements. Disembedded markets are associated with exposure, with being left to swim naked in the icy waters of egotistical calculation, quoting Marx. These inflections, embedded markets are good, disembedded markets bad, carry over to the double movement. The first, exposing movement, brings disaster. The second, protective movement, offers the chance to restore the health of humanity, society, and nature. Now, what should we make of these ideas? On its face, the distinction between embedded and disembedded markets has a great deal to offer to critical theorizing. For one thing, as I already suggested, it points beyond economism to an expansive understanding of capitalist crisis as a multifaceted historical process, as much social, political, and ecological as economic. For another, it points beyond functionalism, grasping crisis not as an objective system breakdown, but as an intersubjective process that includes the responses of social actors to perceived shifts in their situation and to one another. Then, too, Polanyi's distinction makes possible a critique that does not reject markets as such, but only the dangerous disembedded variety. Consequently, the concept of an embedded market affords the prospect of a progressive alternative, both to the wanton disembedding promoted by neoliberals and to the wholesale suppression of markets traditionally favored by socialists. Nevertheless, the evaluative subtext of Polanyi's categories is problematic. On the one hand, his account of embedded markets and social protections is far too rosy. Romanticizing society, it occults the fact that the communities in which markets have historically been embedded have also been the locus of oppression. Conversely, Polanyi's account of disembedding is a bit too dark. Having idealized society, it occludes the fact that whatever their other effects, processes that disembed markets from oppressive protections contain at least an emancipatory moment. Now, let me be clear. Polanyi never intended to idealize traditional society, let alone to endorse oppression. An independent socialist, he advocated re-embedding markets in egalitarian democratic regimes precisely in order to forestall the return of authoritarian fascist alternatives. So he clearly recognized that not all regimes of protection were morally equivalent. But Polanyi never translated his moral intuitions into normative theoretical terms. Conceptually, his framework remains tied to an inadequate evaluative distinction between good embedded markets and bad disembedded markets. So we present-day critical theorists must revise this framework, avoiding both wholesale condemnation of disembedding and wholesale approbation of re-embedding. We must open both prongs of the double movement to critical scrutiny, exposing the normative deficits of society as well as those of economy. We must validate struggles against oppression wherever it roots. Now, to this end, I propose to draw on a resource not utilized by Polanyi, namely the insights of emancipatory movements. Unmasking power asymmetries occluded by him, these movements exposed the predatory underside of the embedded markets he tended to idealize. Exploiting their insights and drawing on the benefits of hindsight, I propose to rethink the double movement in relation to struggles for emancipation. Now, to speak of emancipation is to introduce a category that does not appear in the Great Transformation. But the idea, and indeed even the word, figured importantly throughout the period Polanyi chronicled. One need only mention epical struggles to abolish slavery, liberate women, and free your non-European peoples from colonial subjection, all waged in the name of emancipation. Now, it is surely odd that these struggles should be absent from a work purporting to chart the rise and fall of what it calls 19th century civilization. But my point is not simply to flag an omission. It is rather to note that struggles for emancipation directly challenged oppressive forms of social protection, while neither wholly condemning nor simply celebrating marketization. Had they been included, these movements would have destabilized the dualistic narrative schema of the Great Transformation. The effect would have been to explode the double movement. Now, to see why, consider that emancipation differs importantly from Polanyi's chief positive category, namely social protection. Whereas protection is exposed to exposure, emancipation is opposed to oppression. While protection aims to shield society from the disintegrative effects of unregulated markets, emancipation aims to expose oppressive relations wherever they root, in society as well as in economy. While the thrust of protection is to subject market exchange to non-economic norms, that of emancipation is to subject both market exchange and non-market norms to critical scrutiny. Finally, whereas protection's highest value is social security, emancipation's priority is social justice. And of course, these don't necessarily overlap. It would be wrong, however, to conclude that emancipation is always allied with marketization. If emancipation opposes oppression, marketization opposes the extra economic regulation of production and exchange, whether such regulation is meant to protect or indeed to liberate. While marketization defends the supposed autonomy of the economy, understood formally as a demarcated sphere of instrumental action, emancipation ranges across the boundaries that demarcate spheres, seeking to root out oppression from every sphere. While the thrust of marketization is to liberate buying and selling from moral and ethical norms, that of emancipation is to scrutinize all types of norms from a normative standpoint. Finally, whereas marketization claims efficiency as its highest value, emancipation's priority, as I just said, is social justice. Now, it follows that struggles for emancipation do not map neatly onto either prong of Polanyi's double movement. Granted, such struggles appear on occasion to converge with marketization, as, for example, when they condemn as oppressive the very social protections that free marketeers seek to eradicate. On other occasions, however, they converge with protectionist projects, as, for example, when they denounce the oppressive effects of deregulation. on still other occasions, finally, struggles for emancipation diverge from both prongs of the double movement, as when they aim neither to dismantle nor to defend existing protections, but rather to transform the mode of protection. So convergences, where they exist, are conjunctural and contingent, aligned consistently neither with protection nor deregulation. Struggles for emancipation represent a third force that disrupts Polanyi's dualistic schema. To give such struggles their due requires us to revise his framework by transforming its double movement into a triple movement. Now, how exactly might such a transformation be effected? One part of the job involves revising the social institutional basis of Polanyi's framework. Critical theorists must replace his dualism of economy and society with a more complex societal schema, which can accommodate sources of historical dynamism other than marketization. Such sources, which in our history have included the rise of science, conscious-based religiosity, autonomous art, personalized sexual love, and subjective rights-based law, have their own independent disembedding effects, which cannot be assimilated to those of economic deregulation. The disembedding at work here opens communities less to the instrumental calculations of commerce than to the communicative dynamics of civil society. Nurturing non-economic modes of individualization, these forms of disembedding are the seedbeds of emancipation. No perspective that ignores them can serve to elucidate the full dynamics of capitalist crisis. Although social theoretical reconstruction is needed to develop the triple movement, I shall not pursue it here. In this lecture, I focus instead on another key aspect of that revised figure, namely its normative content. Here again, I depart from Polanyi, who never sought to systematize the normative intuitions that pervade his writings, and who therefore missed the chance to develop a more adequate basis for evaluating projects of deregulation and social protection. Unlike him, I assume that critical theorists need to clarify and to justify normative bases of social critique. So how ought we to understand the normative content of emancipation? Consider just four of the many social movements that have mobilized under that banner, namely feminism, anti-imperialism, multiculturalism, and the New Left. Clearly, these movements did not share an explicit understanding of emancipation, and the modes of oppression they sought to overcome were highly diverse. I believe, however, that a single normative aspiration subtends most, if not all, of their claims, namely the aspiration to dismantle institutionalized obstacles that prevent some people from participating fully on a par with others in social life. Thus, a major target of feminist protest is an androcentric status order institutionalized throughout society, which precludes women's full participation on a par with men. For anti-imperialists, the central issue has been a division of political economic space that denies non-Europeans the capacity to establish parity of participation in their own societies and that prevents them from participating on a par with Europeans in transnational society. For multiculturalists, the chief target is a design of public space that institutionalizes majority ethnic or majority religious self-understandings, thereby denying parity of participation to members of minorities. For New Leftists, the burning issue was a bureaucratic organization of social protection that disempowers ordinary citizens and precludes their active participation in democratic life. Now, clearly, these obstacles to participatory parity take different forms. In some cases, the principal locus of oppression is society in Polanyi's sense, while in others it is the economy, and in still others it is the state. Thus, the substantive content of emancipation varies accordingly. In some struggles, emancipation means transforming the status order so as to establish the equal standing required for participatory parity. In other struggles, emancipation means transforming the political economy so as to ensure access to the resources needed for full participation. In still other struggles, emancipation means transforming the political constitution so as to establish the basis for roughly equal voice in matters involving the exercise of public power. And of course, there are many cases in which more than one of these meanings of emancipation is in play simultaneously. Whatever the struggle in question, however, emancipation's implicit thrust is to vindicate, I claim, a single normative principle which oppression violates, namely the principle of participatory parity. Elsewhere, I have sought to provide a fuller explication and philosophical defense of this principle. Here, I want simply to note that it provides an account of emancipation that suits this figure of the triple movement. Equally sensitive to status hierarchies, class differentials, and political asymmetries, which is to say to misrecognition, maldistribution, and misrepresentation, the principle of participatory parity targets harms associated with three major institutional centers, namely society, economy, and state. So it extends the reach of critique beyond the depredations of deregulation to include as well the oppressions of social protection. Now, it's an open question, as I have said, how exactly projects of emancipation, understood in terms of participatory parity, relate to efforts to disembed markets on the one hand and to efforts to protect society on the other. The crucial thing, as we shall see, is that all three projects be examined together in close relation to one another. And that is precisely the thesis I shall argue now. In the remainder of this lecture, I propose to bring Polanyi's framework into direct communication with claims for emancipation. I propose specifically to consider the claims of two of the four social movements just mentioned, in this case, feminism and anti-imperialism. If I had more time, I'd talk about the other two, but I will talk about multiculturalism tomorrow. I will argue that each of these movements claims explodes the double movement by disclosing a different way in which social protections can be oppressive. To anticipate the argument, I will show first that feminist claims unmask the oppressive character of social protections that are premised on status hierarchies. And second, that anti-imperialist claims expose the oppressive character of social protections that have been gerrymandered to exclude some relevant actors. So first, feminism. The social and political arrangements that embed markets can be oppressive in virtue of being hierarchical. In such cases, they entrench status differentials that deny some who are included in principle as members of society the social preconditions for full participation. The classic example is gender hierarchy, which assigns women a lesser status, often akin to that of a male child, and thereby prevents them from participating fully on a par with men in social interaction. But one could also cite caste hierarchies, including those premised on ideologies of race. In all such cases, social protections work to the advantage of those at the top of the status hierarchy, affording lesser, if any, benefit to those at the bottom. What they protect, accordingly, is less society per se than social hierarchy. No wonder, then, that feminist, anti-racist, and anti-caste movements have mobilized against such hierarchies, rejecting the protections they purport to offer. Insisting on full membership in society, They have sought to dismantle arrangements that deny them the social prerequisites of participatory power. The feminist critique of hierarchy runs through every stage of Polanyi's history, although it is never mentioned by him. During the mercantilist era, feminists like Mary Wollstonecraft criticized the traditional social arrangements that embedded markets, condemning the gender hierarchies entrenched in family, religion, law, and social custom. They demanded such fundamental prerequisites of participatory parity as an independent legal personality, religious freedom, education, the right to refuse sex, rights of custody in their children, and the right to speak in public and to vote. During the period of laissez-faire, feminists demanded equal access to the market. Exposing the latter's instrumentalization of sexist norms, they opposed protections that denied them the right to own property, sign contracts, control wages, practice professions, work the same hours, and receive the same pay as men, all prerequisites of full participation in social life. During the post-World War II era, so-called second-wave feminists targeted what they called the public patriarchy instituted by democratic welfare states. Condemning social protections premised on the idea of the family wage, they demanded equal pay for work of comparable worth, parity for caregiving and wage earning and social entitlements, and an end to the gender division of labor, both paid and unpaid. In each of these epochs, feminists raised claims for emancipation aimed at dismantling obstacles to participatory parity. At some moments, they targeted traditional community structures that embedded markets. At others, they aimed their fire at the forces that were disembedding markets. At still others, their principal foes were those who were re-embedding markets in oppressive ways. So feminist claims did not align consistently with either pole of Polanyi's double movement. On the contrary, their struggles for emancipation constituted a third prong, which cut across the other two prongs. What Polanyi called a double movement was, in actuality, a triple movement. Now, the social and political arrangements that embed markets can also be oppressive in a second way, in virtue of being misframed. As Dean Post mentioned, misframing is a neologism I have coined for mismatches of scale. In this case, a mismatch between the scale at which markets are embedded on the one hand and the scale at which they expose people to danger on the other. The oppression of misframing arises when protective arrangements wrongly exclude some of those exposed, while saddling them with the costs of protecting others. Now, misframing differs from hierarchy as a mode of oppression. Whereas hierarchy denies parity to internal subordinates, misframing excludes external others. While hierarchical protections deny peer standing to some who are nevertheless recognized as members of society, misframe protections deny the status of membership to some on whose activities society relies. The clearest examples of misframe protection are those associated with colonialism and its post-colonial neo-imperial successor regimes. In these cases, the arrangements that embed markets serve the citizens of the metropolitan powers at the expense of peripheral subjects. The latter's exploitation subsidizes the former's protection. Now, Polanyi himself laid the basis for the critique of misframed protections, although he did not articulate it explicitly. In The Great Transformation, he observed first that political states are necessary prerequisites for successful social protection, and second, that they are unevenly available in the modern world. He writes, and I quote, "If the organized states of Europe could protect themselves against the backwash of international free trade, the politically unorganized colonial peoples could not. The protection which the white man could easily secure for himself through the sovereign status of his communities was out of reach of the colored man as long as he lacked the prerequisite political government, end quote. Now, what exactly had caused the colored man's lack? At the height of what they called laissez-faire, European powers used their colonies both as dedicated sources of raw materials and cheap foodstuffs and also as protected outlets for their manufactured goods. So colonialism served to protect European industry and to cushion European peoples from the harshest effects of unregulated capitalism while depriving colonized peoples of the means of protection. It seemed to follow that colonized peoples would gain protection by achieving independence and acquiring states of their own. But even after decolonization, that goal proved elusive. The reason has to do with yet another Polanyian insight. The regulatory capacities of states depend importantly on international arrangements. Observing that the gold standard free trade regime of the early 20th century had prevented European states from adopting protective policies like full employment or deficit spending, which depend on control of the money supply, Polanyi concluded that the post-World War II international regime should be designed so as to facilitate protective policies at the national level, to give states the capacity to institute such policies. What he did not anticipate, however, was that the so-called embedded liberalism, that's John Ruggie's phrase, that was established after the war served some states better than others. In that period, when imperialism assumed the non-political form of unequal exchange between newly independent ex-colonies and their erstwhile masters, the latter continued to finance their domestic welfare systems on the backs of the former. The disparity was exacerbated, moreover, in our own time, in the neoliberal era, by the policy of structural adjustment. As international agencies like the IMF used the weapon of debt to further undercut the protective capacities of post-colonial states, compelling them to divest their assets, open their markets, and slash social spending. Historically, therefore, international arrangements have entrenched disparities in the capacities of states to protect their populations. They have permitted the domestic re-embedding of markets by the states of the core, but not by those of the periphery. No wonder, then, that anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movements mobilized against misframed protections. In each historical era, they raised claims for emancipation, which again cannot be fitted into Polanyi's schema. Prior to independence, they sought national liberation, whether by negotiated transition or armed insurrection. After independence, they challenged the governance structures of the global economy, such as the WTO and the IMF. So at some moments, anti-imperialists targeted the forces that were disembedding their own local markets from their own pre-colonial societies, while at others, they targeted the forces that were re-embedding European markets at their expense. Like the claims of feminists then, the claims of anti-imperialists did not align consistently with either prong of Polanyi's double movement. In their case, too, struggles for emancipation constituted a distinct third force. Here, too, what Polanyi called a double movement is better grasped as a triple movement encompassing marketization, social protection, and emancipation. Now, this discussion, I think, has established two closely interrelated points. We have seen first, thanks to feminists and anti-imperialists, that the social arrangements that re-embed markets can be seriously flawed. Even in democratic welfare states, social protections can be oppressive insofar as they are hierarchical and/or misframed. A critical theory of our time must reject Polanyi's exclusive focus on harms flowing from deregulation. It must subject protection, too, to critical scrutiny. From this it follows, and this is my second point, that neither the great transformation described by Polanyi nor the one we are living through now, can be adequately understood by the figure of the double movement. In reducing the logic of crisis to a two-sided conflict between marketization and social protection, that figure allows no place for this third important force, which I have called emancipation. The problem is not only the omission of a major driver of historical development. In addition, the foreclosure of emancipation distorts our understanding of the two projects discussed by Polanyi. Neither marketization nor social protection can be adequately understood without factoring in struggles for emancipation. I want to conclude by spelling out exactly why that is so and what is to be gained by transforming Polanyi's double movement into a triple movement. Let me note first that the triple movement builds on the principal virtues of Polanyi's approach. Like him, it comprehends capitalist crisis in a non-economistic fashion as a social process that encompasses culture, ecology, and politics, as well as economy. As a matter of fact, one could say that the approach I am proposing here overcomes economism more thoroughly than Polanyi did, as it recognizes a non-economic source of historical dynamism in emancipation. In other words, for him, sort of all the push comes from economy, and then all you get from, the only other thing you have is a kind of reaction from society. But I think that I'm trying to suggest that that emancipation is itself a dynamic historical force. Like Polanyi, too, the triple movement understands crisis in a non-functionalist fashion as an intersubjective process that includes the responses of social actors to perceive shifts in their situation and to one another. In fact, I would say again, it better overcomes functionalism than Polanyi did by incorporating an important actor perspective omitted by him. Even as it builds on Polanyi's strengths, however, the triple movement overcomes the chief limitations of his approach. First, it overcomes the conceptual inadequacy of the double movement by introducing emancipation as the mediating third. Second, it overcomes the normative inadequacy of Polanyi's framework by grounding its evaluative judgments on the principle of participatory parity. The resulting perspective promises to help elucidate the great transformation of the 20th century. The triple movement conceptualizes capitalist crisis as a three-sided conflict among marketization, social protection, and emancipation. In our time, each of these orientations has zealous exponents. Marketization is fervently championed by neoliberals. Social protection commands support in various forms, some savory, some unsavory, from social democratic and trade union nationalists, from neo-traditional religious movements, from globalization activists, environmentalists, and indigenous peoples. Emancipation fires the passions of the various successors to the new social movements, including multiculturalists, international feminists, gay and lesbian liberationists, cosmopolitan Democrats, human rights activists, and proponents of global justice. It is the complex relations among these three types of projects that impresses the shape of a triple movement on the present crisis of capitalist society. To clarify this constellation, critical theorists should treat each term of the triple movement as conceptually irreducible, normatively ambivalent, and inextricably entangled with the other two. We have already seen, contra Polanyi, that social protection is often ambivalent, affording relief from the disintegrative effects of deregulation while simultaneously entrenching oppression. But the same is true of the other two terms. Deregulation of markets does indeed have the negative effects Polanyi stressed, but it can also beget positive effects to the extent that the protections it disintegrates are oppressive. Nor is emancipation immune to ambivalences, as it produces not only liberation, but also social strains that complicate efforts to build political coalitions that are sufficiently broad and powerful to overcome private interests and effectively protect people and nature from corporate predation. Seen this way, each term has both a telos of its own and a potential for ambivalence that unfolds through its interactions with the other two terms. None of the three can be adequately grasped in isolation from the others, nor can the social field be adequately grasped by focusing on only two terms. It is only when all three are considered together that we begin to get an adequate view of capitalist crisis. Here, then, is the core premise of the triple movement. The relation between any two sides of the three-sided conflict must be mediated by the third. Thus, as I have argued here, the conflict between marketization and social protection must be mediated by emancipation. Equally, however, as I will argue tomorrow, conflicts between protection and emancipation must be mediated by marketization. In both cases, the dyad must be mediated by the third. This point suggests a way of rewriting Polanyi's project. By theorizing the double movement, he portrayed the conflicts of his time as an epical battle for the soul of the market. Will nature, labor, and money be stripped of all ethical meaning, sliced, diced, and traded like widgets into hell with the consequences? Or will markets in those fundamental bases of human society be subject to ethically and morally informed political regulation? That battle remains as pressing as ever in the 21st century. But the triple movement casts it in a sharper light, as cross-cut by two other major battles of epical significance. One is a battle for the soul of social protection. Will the arrangements that re-embed markets in the post-neoliberal era be hierarchical or egalitarian, misframed or well-framed, difference hostile or difference friendly, bureaucratic or participatory? The other cross-cutting epical battle is for the soul of emancipation. Will the emancipatory struggles of the 21st century serve to advance the disembedding and deregulation of markets, or will they serve to democratize and to make just social protection? These, I submit, are among the most pressing questions that critical theorists might pose today. It is in the hopes of clarifying them that I have tried in the present lecture to outline a neo-Polanyian conception of capitalist crisis. In tomorrow's lecture, I will use the perspective developed here to analyze the great transformation of the 21st century. Thank you.